Good morning, everybody, and welcome to episode 34 of our monthly Media Experts Q&A session with Cinten's employment team. As I say every time, thank you so much for your continued positive comments about these sessions, for continuing to sign in for them, for tuning into them each month, sending any questions, and obviously watching the video online afterwards and listening to the podcast version. We don't take it for granted. Just moving the slides on, our speakers this morning are there in front of you, Head of Department and Partner Keith Land, and Elsa Hobson, who is actually a Senior Associate now, but I have neglected to update that on the slide. So apologies, Elsa, I very quickly oversaved the previous one and not in any way meaning to demote you there. So it's Senior Associate Elsa Hobson and obviously myself just doing the introduction. Now, usually we do three questions, but today we're going to do two. Elsa's going to deal with question one, and question two is part two from last month, where Keith decided to, as it was such a large topic, he decided to split it into two parts. So Elsa's going to go first. So without any further ado, I'll stop talking and pass over to Elsa. Elsa, good morning and over to you.
Thanks, David, and thank you for the lovely introduction. Yes, we're only going to do two questions today. I think Keith's part two is probably going to be quite long, so we didn't want to keep you on too much longer than we promised. And he tends to waffle on, you know this, you've listened to him before. Anyway, moving on to the first question. So is there a requirement for an irreducible minimum obligation to accept or offer work when considering worker status? So the short answer to this is no, but I'll obviously not stop there because that gives you very little to work with. This question arises from a recent case that I've read actually yesterday, which went to the Court of Appeal. It's Nursing and Midwifery Council and versus Somerville. So I chose this question because it's a topic of frustration for many, including me, as the definition of work has always been a little bit woolly. So the employee definition is a lot more straightforward. Employees are defined as those who work under a common law contract of employment, also known as a contract of service. One of the key elements of a contract of service is mutuality of obligation. So that's the obligation on the employer to provide work and on the employee to accept and perform the work that's offered. So mutuality of obligation is generally not a key element of worker status, but some worker cases have taken it to account, so hence the woolly confusion. So this case has brought a little bit of clarity to the point for now, so we'll see how long that lasts. I'll start with the definition of a worker, which is an individual who works under a contract whereby the individual undertakes to do or perform personally any work or service for another party to the contract whose status is not by virtue of the contract that of a client or customer of any profession or business undertaking carried on by the individual. Obviously, long-winded. The latter part draws a distinction as to how the services are performed. So were they on behalf of, we'll call them the employer for ease, and under their direction and control? Or was it the delivery of a service like a client and a customer? So quite similar, I suppose, to the legal services that we can provide you. If you need them, you know where we are. In this case, Somerville was a fee-paid panel member of the NMC's Fitness to Practice Committee. He was engaged as an independent contractor, so he was deemed self-employed by both, well, himself at the time and the NMC. The NMC were not required to offer Somerville work, and he's not required to accept it. If he did accept it, then he must do all that he could to complete it, but cancellation was possible on both sides without any penalisation to Somerville. Somerville's availability was given 6 months in advance and hearings were offered to suit his other commitments. In 2018, Somerville obviously changed his stance on the relationship and brought claims in the Employment Tribunal for holiday pay and or unauthorised deductions under the Employment Rights Act, both of which require employee or worker status to succeed. The tribunal found at a preliminary hearing, so they decided this on a preliminary point before it went to final hearing, that Somerville was not an employee as there was no contractual obligation to offer or accept work from either party, and he was free to withdraw from the dates that were set at any time. There was therefore insufficient mutuality of obligation. So there's that word again. They then went on to find that as there was no right of substitution, so Somerville had to require the, he had to perform the work personally, and the NMC was not a client or customer of a professional business that he carried out, he did satisfy the definition of a worker. This means that he was entitled to his holiday pay. So the NMC appealed first to the EAT and then on to the Court of Appeal. So the basis of the NMC's appeal was that to satisfy the definition of worker, there must be some mutuality of obligation, an irreducible minimum of obligation, so at least some amount of work to be offered and accepted. Neither the EAT or the Court of Appeal accepted the argument. They referred to the tests applied in both the two big worker cases, which was Pilmico Plumbers and the Uber case, neither of which laid down any general test for worker status to arise. There must be that irreducible minimum obligation. The Court of Appeal held that the fact that the contracts did not impose an obligation to work did not preclude a finding that Somerville was a worker while he was actually undertaking the work for the NMC, so during those assignments that he did accept and perform. They found that it was sufficient that there was a requirement for him to provide that work personally, so not to substitute, and that the NMC were not a client or a customer of his linked to his profession. So I think it's a pretty clear decision and one that could impact. I mean, there have been a lot of cases around at the moment about worker status, and I think they're all seem to be focusing in the same direction, that making that definition a lot clearer. It doesn't necessarily help to serve self-employed people or individuals operating via service companies, because obviously the impact of IR 35, because that assessment of a self-employed person is going to be even more rigid, really, because the real focus and the real importance seems to be on the right of substitution, so that requirement to perform the work personally, and on the way the services are actually performed by the individual. So you have to really, it doesn't matter really what goes in the contract if the reality isn't reflected. So how much are the individuals in control of the work that they do, and can they increase their own potential for fee income, or is that relationship very much dictated and controlled by the person that they're working for? Are they actually providing a service, or are they really doing the work of an employee but on their own terms and under the direction on their own terms under the contract, but still under the direction and control of the employer? So there's a lot to think about when you're actually looking at self-employed contractors. And sometimes you find employees want to retire but come back as consultants. What are they doing when they come back as consultants? Are they actually performing a service, or are they just doing what they were doing before, but in a different way, for less hours, for example? So it's really important that you carry out that full assessment at the beginning, because it's highly likely that in a lot of circumstances, those that are self-employed will be workers in some capacity, which means things like holiday pay, sick pay, they're all thrown into the mix, and it can be a bit of a backdated headache. But it'll always be a difficult assessment. But what this case does do is it removes the focus from the obligation to offer or do work, and it re-emphasises the importance of the reality of the situation, how the work's performed and who needs to perform it. So I think it's really helpful in my view. Keith, I don't know if you have anything to add or...
I didn't have anything to add, to be perfectly honest with you. I think you've done a really good summary.
Thanks.
It's a difficult case that, it's a difficult area that turns on its facts in each case. So every time you come up against the question, you've got to apply the kind of things that you've been talking about and come up with your own individual assessment. But you're right, there has been a lot of sort of mystery around the difference between worker, employee, and self-employed person, and it puts some much needed sort of clarity on some of the tests that should be helpful for people.
Great. Well, that's all for me. I'll hand back straight over to you, Keith.
Okay. Right, this is part two of a session I started last week. Ailsa suggested that she might chip in, but only where it's becoming boring and monotonous. And so if Ailsa's voice pops in from this point forward, you know what her view of my presentation is. No pressure. Right, comparators in discrimination. Where to start? Okay, quick recap from last time. Five forms of discrimination. Direct, you treat somebody differently because of a condition. Indirect, and I'll go into that in a bit more detail in a minute. Harassment, a hostile atmosphere as a consequence of protected characteristic. Victimization, you attack somebody because they are involved with a claim of discrimination, they raise an issue of discrimination, okay? And then a latter one, which applies to disability discrimination only, which is discrimination arising from disability, which is beyond today's talk. Okay, those are sort of your five forms of discrimination. And comparators come in on direct and indirect discrimination. And so I dealt with direct discrimination last time, so I'm going to leave that well alone. And I'm going to deal with indirect discrimination. Okay. What is indirect discrimination? Okay. Indirect discrimination occurs where an employer, I use employer, it's wider than that because, but it's easier for the context of this talk. An employer applies what we lawyers call a PCP to an employee. A PCP is a legal term which refers to a provision, criterion, or practice. Okay, it's wide enough to be pretty much anything. So you apply a rule to your employees, and a group that holds a protected characteristic struggles to meet that PCP, then there could be the question of indirect discrimination arising. Let me put some context on it. Women, for example, working fixed working hours of 9 to 5. Because they have childcare responsibilities, may struggle. That is a PCP, the requirement to work 9 to 5. Women may struggle to meet it because their childcare responsibilities, therefore potential discrimination. Similar, the government brought in to care homes a requirement to have a COVID-19 vaccination during the pandemic, or to be able to evidence an exemption. Again, even though that was forced on an employer, by legislation, it would still qualify as a PCP, a requirement to be vaccinated. Okay. That PCP is applied to everybody. The employee who has a protected characteristic, okay, struggles to meet that PCP and abide by it. And there is a greater group of people of which the employee is part, who also struggle to meet that PCP when compared to those people who don't have the PCP. Now, this is where comparators come in, because there needs to be this comparison. So, for example, a woman, again, working 9 to 5 working hours, or being asked to work 9 to 5 working hours, that is the PCP, struggles to meet it due to childcare responsibilities, and is treated at a disadvantage when compared to men who don't have the childcaring responsibilities. Hopefully you are following that. The PCP must put the individual and the wider group at a disadvantage, okay? And the PCP must not be justified. Just because there is a PCP, somebody can't meet it, potential discrimination, doesn't mean that there is an act of discrimination, because indirect discrimination is one of those areas that can be justified, okay? And therefore, if an employer has good enough business operational reasons for having that disparate impact on a specific group, they may be able to do it and avoid being guilty of discrimination. Okay, but I'm dealing with comparators today. So there must be a comparison between the pool of people, the group that have the protected characteristics, compared with those that don't have it. And thus there is this artificial comparator that is created. The reason for that is to show that the protected characteristic is the specific reason for the difference in treatment of the two people, or the two groups of people, let's say. Hopefully you're all following me. Ailsa, you're nodding?
Yeah, I'm not bored yet.
Okay, she's not bored yet. Brilliant. Okay, so how does the tribunal deal with this? Well, okay, it breaks, we lawyers love things in little boxes, okay? So the tribunals do too. And they break this sort of analysis into, the tribunal, when faced with this question, breaks the analysis into stages and questions, okay? First one being, it will identify the protected characteristic, for example, sex or gender, okay? It will then identify what the PCP is in a specific case. Working fixed hours 9 to 5 in my examples, or the requirement to have a COVID-19 vaccination in a care home, for example. It will then ask itself, has it applied that PCP to all staff or a specific group of staff? Yes or no? And if yes, it will proceed on. Does that PCP place those with a protected characteristic as a disadvantage when compared to those that don't, i.e. does the PCP place women at a disadvantage when compared to men? Okay, and that is the crux of the comparator. Then the tribunal asks itself whether the PCP places the specific individual employee who's brought the claim at the disadvantage, and then it decides whether there's some form of justification. Okay, that is a complete mouthful, and it's really difficult, complex stuff. Better illustrated by two examples. Okay, so I'm actually going to run through three to illustrate it. The first one, okay, is based on gender, the protected characteristics of gender or sex, and it's the one I've been talking about. It's working hours. It's the most common one that exists in the UK, so I'll walk through it in the same way. So the requirement to have a woman working 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. every day, 5 days a week, okay? What's the protected characteristic we're looking at here? Well, it's gender. It's a woman's sex, okay? The PCP is the requirement to work 9 to 5. Okay, that's applied to the woman, and it's applied to everyone in the business, okay, because that's the working hours of the business. What's the disadvantage for the specific employee? Well, this lady is going to struggle to meet it because she has kids, and then she has to drop them off at school at 9, and she has to pick them up at 4 o'clock. So how can she work 9 to 5? It's a struggle for her. What's the group disadvantage for women? Well, the statistics show that more women than men in the UK have childcare responsibility, and therefore there is this group disadvantage that applies. So the woman, it impacts her disadvantage, she can't do it, and there is a group, more women than men look after the kids, they struggle to meet those fixed working hours. Okay, so does the PCP create a disadvantage for women when compared to men? Okay, so what the law does, it creates this hypothetical situation where you say, okay, we're going to have a woman working 9 to 5 and a man working office hours 9 to 5. They both have exactly the same position. And is there a disadvantage caused? Well, yes, there is, because a woman is under more pressure because she struggles to be there 9 to 5 because she's got to collect little Johnny and little Mary from school or drop them off, get them home and get their tea so they don't starve. Okay, so yes, there would be a disparate impact in that situation when you compare the two different genders. Doesn't mean it's the end of the story, because there's justification, and it would depend on the job. If there are operational reasons that those people have to be in the business 9 to 5, it's possibly justifiable to have a discriminatory impact. You would then have to look at things like the requirements of flexibility. Does a woman really need to be there beyond 4 o'clock? Could they go home, and could they complete their work from 5 till 6 or 6 till 7? That's why we have all these things around flexibility, which actually the pandemic has helped us out with. Following me so far? Ilse, give me a thumbs up. Yeah, she's nodding. Okay, so second example, which is going to give me a different outcome, which is this the question I've talked about of vaccination. The government brought in vaccinations within care homes. It said, to have somebody enter a care home because of the pandemic, anybody working there apart from a visitor or the residents themselves would have to show evidence that they've had a completed course of the COVID-19 vaccination, or there are clinical reasons that they can't have it. That is the PCP, the requirement to evidence vaccination or the clinical reasons why you couldn't enter the why you couldn't have a CV19 vaccination. Okay. If I apply that to gender and sex, the protected characteristic is gender and sex. Disadvantage of the employee, specific employee who's a woman, is not being able to come into the home because they can't evidence vaccination status, and they can't evidence a clinical reason why they shouldn't have a CV19 vaccination. So they can't come into the home, they can't work. Group disadvantage, more women than men work in a care home. Therefore, is there a disparate impact on women? Yes, potentially. Okay, what is the disparate impact then when compared to men? Okay, so this is where the comparator comes in. So we create a comparator between men and women that are in exactly the same position, but remove the gender. Okay, so what we would have is we'd say, okay, or you have a different gender, you don't remove the gender, if you see what I mean. So you take this hypothetical comparator and you say, okay, I have a male employee who is not able to evidence a completed course of a COVID-19 vaccination and is not able to evidence the clinical reasons why they couldn't have a COVID-19 vaccination, how would that person be treated? Well, they would not be able to enter the home. They would be treated in exactly the same manner as a female in exactly the same circumstances. So in effect, no difference in treatment, no disparate, different impact on the group that is the women when compared to men when you apply this comparator test. They're both treated the same way. Neither men nor women would be entitled to come into the home. Therefore, no different treatment, no discrimination. What you've got to remember here, discrimination is all about different treatment between different protected groups. Hopefully you're seeing what I'm meaning. Ailsa hasn't interrupted, so she can't be that bored and I can't have gone off piste. So if I apply a different, protected characteristic to that last scenario on vaccination, so I use philosophical belief, so somebody does not have the vaccine because of a philosophical belief, let's choose my body, my choice. Okay, and I work through that test. Okay, what's the PCP? It's the same one, the requirement to have the vaccination or to be able to evidence exemption. What's the protected characteristic? Philosophical belief, my body, my choice. What's the disadvantage for the employee that is has this ethical view on life? They can't come into the home, they can't work, therefore they're going to get dismissed. What's the group disadvantage? The group disadvantage for somebody that shares that same philosophical belief is that they can't come into the home, they can't work, they will be fired as well. So there's a group for somebody holding the same philosophical belief as my body, my choice. Okay. So is there a disparate impact when you compare those that have the philosophical belief with those that don't have the philosophical belief? Well, you do. Okay. There is a disparate impact. So If you have the same person that says, okay, I'm not having the vaccine because of my philosophical beliefs, I'm not exempt in any way, I just won't take the vaccine because I believe in my body by choice and that vaccine frightens me. And I have a choice as to put into my body what I will, and I just don't want to have that vaccine, okay? That person will be dismissed from their job. Okay, they can't come in the home, they can't do the job, they're going to get dismissed. You then have the person that does not hold that philosophical belief. They'll be treated in a very different way because they'll be able to show that they could get the vaccine because they'll take the vaccine. If, on the other hand, you have somebody that doesn't take the vaccine for other reasons, they'll be treated in exactly the same way. But the comparator here is somebody. You've got to remove the philosophical belief so effectively you get a difference in treatment between the two people, i.e. one will be able to come in the home and one won't. You're following me? Good. Hopefully you are. So disparate impact, potential discrimination. That is not, however, the end of the story, because you then have the defense of justification if you're an employer. Okay. And if your PCP is a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim, then whilst there might be a discriminatory impact on one particular group holding that philosophical belief of my body, my choice, it could still be justified. For example, in a care home, this system has been brought in, people are vaccinated or they have to show a clinical exemption why they can't take a vaccination to keep the vulnerable residents in the home safe. That is clearly a legitimate aim because the needs of the people who are the vulnerable in our society need to be protected. And consequently, it's a proportionate step to ensure that everyone's vaccinated and everyone's doing the best that they can to protect those vulnerable people from an illness, which in many cases would potentially kill them during the pandemic. Therefore, whilst there is a disparate discriminatory impact, it is probably justifiable. I think I've done that to death, if you would pardon the pun. Hopefully you see the distinctions as to why a comparator exists. And if you apply it in that logical manner, you get to the position where in some circumstances, it weeds out the discriminatory impact. Ailsa, anything to add?
Only, I don't think that you mentioned it. Just obviously, I understand why you use that example of the vaccine, just to flag that that law was then changed and there's no requirement in that sector to get the vaccine anymore. Just to highlight that now. Obviously, it's relevant when it was, not so relevant now.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I use it as an illustration to example how the different groups of treatment. Obviously, Ailes is dead right. The law on compulsory vaccinations in care homes was pulled and dropped by the government, and so it no longer exists. But there it is. I could have picked on a million and one examples.
Okay,
I think I'm done. David, over to you to wrap up.
Thank you very much. Very quickly from me, we continue to work hard to produce and deliver relevant, useful content for you, articles, blogs, podcasts, videos, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk, should you wish to take a look. And in about half an hour's time, this will include all 34 episodes of this Q&A session. You can also follow the employment team on Twitter at SintonsHR. I put our speakers' details there back on the screen. If you have anything you'd like to discuss with them further, please don't hesitate to get in touch. Our next session will be with you on Friday, the 29th of July at 10 a.m. and we will send you the link round near the time. I'll be by the side of a pool in the south of France, so it'll be my colleague Peter who will be doing the intros and outros. As whilst I love the guys, I'm not breaking my holiday to do this. So all that's left to say is thank you very much for listening. Stay safe, everyone, and we'll speak to you next time.